Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Johnny Vedmore is TNT's new UK drive time host. He's an investigative journalist, musician, and activist from Cardiff, Wales. Cardiff, Wales. Save the whales. Save the whales. He's the host of the Johnny Vedmore Show on TNT. TNT. He's the host of the Johnny Vedmore Show on TNT. TNT. He put Lou Reed in his Instagram, so I liked him right away. And he wore sunglasses, and I wore sunglasses. What gives? Oh no! He's the host of the Johnny Vedmore Show on TNT. TNT. He's the host of the Johnny Vedmore Show on TNT. Welcome to the show, Johnny Vedmore. How are you, my friend? I can't believe you wore sunglasses. I took a chance and wore sunglasses today, and then you come up on my screen in sunglasses. What's going on with sunglasses today?
Best welcome ever on the many podcasts and radio shows I've been on, Joseph. That filled me up with full of joy, man. It's a beautiful sunny day. It's a beautiful sunny day, and it's a weekend. You know, I only get one weekend, and so I thought I'd wear Lenin assassin glasses, and then it turns out you wear like Lenin-esque glasses. So you know,
right? I know. This is very weird. This is very weird. I'm feeling insecure now. All of a sudden. Why Lenin assassin glasses? What do you think? Do you think that was a CIA operation? What do you think of that whole Catcher in the Rye scenario? Is that part of the PSYOP?
Well, I think David Whelan's work. I had David Whelan on the show about a month back, and I've done a podcast with him on the Newspace podcast as well, a really long one into his research on the Lenin murder. It's crazy. I mean, he's supposed to have fired hollow points from about 200 yards, and they've all collected in a small little group on his chest. Yet the records show that he was supposed to shoot him in the back, and then he's already supposed to be in the actual building when the shots occurred, and Mark Chapman says that when the when Lenin falls to the floor, he disappears into the concrete. It's like there's so many things in it which are just bizarre. I mean, so super bizarre. But you know what they had to do? He was speaking up about the wrong things. I think there's certain things. I don't think people realize how volatile Northern Ireland was back then and all of that stuff. So he was getting involved in that, and I'm sure there was pressure all over the place to shut him up. And so, yeah, definitely assassinated. Sorry to tell you.
It's interesting because I feel like we need someone like John Lennon these days. You know, the musical community, the musical landscape, there's precious few revolutionaries with large voices speaking up and speaking out, especially for peace as well. I mean, and I saw you posted Lou Reed on your Instagram. I wanted to talk about that too, because you got to think like some of these guys who weren't around for the last few years, a lot of times people talk about, what do you think they would have done in these times? What do you think John Lennon would be doing in this day and age? Do you think he would be writing peace music? Or do you think he would, I don't know, be quiet? And what about Lou Reed?
It depends if we're talking peak Lou Reed or peak John Lennon or older Lou Reed or older John Lennon, because I mean, yeah. I think the reason why they had such good insight was they saw inside the beast. They hung around in these New York scenes, these nightclub scenes, which were just completely and utterly on fire. I mean, it was just crazy times. So they would have been hanging around with people who were also the same people there, intelligence mobsters and banksters and loads of other people. So they would have seen all of them, the same people there, intelligence mobsters and banksters and loads of other people. So they would have seen all of their behavior all over the place. And I reckon they would just chastise. At peak them, they would chastise, but they would chastise in their own way that makes people actually understand, which is the reason why you're not allowed to focus in on that nowadays, because they'll help you understand. They'll give you some sort of like short amount of brief description that'll make you go, okay, I got it now, and that's it. You're on your way. But they don't want that. They have to not let you have people with logic give you logic, and they could give you logic in rhythm, they could give you logic in song, they could give you logic in their speech, they could give you logic because you trusted them as well.
Well, music bypasses logic. That's the thing with it. I mean, that's I think we have a we're overwhelmed by logic on platforms like X, and lots of talking heads and people just kind of coming from their mind space. Whereas a song, you can say something revolutionary in a song, but if it's housed in a melody and some moving emotional landscape, even if someone disagrees with the message, I think their reaction to it is less from the ego and more from the heart.
The problem is that the music industry got wrapped up in a big bow years ago, mixed in with the same people I'm talking about who run the clubs back in New York and places back in the day, the trendy people, the gangsters, the intelligence mobsters. And basically now they've taken all the music out of mainstream music, so these people wouldn't be allowed air anymore. So there's loads of Lou Reeds now, there's loads of John Lennons, more than before probably, but we just don't hear them. Or, you know, I think about the musical career of a guy called Eddick in the UK, part of Ice Cream Headache. And no one knows him, but a few of his albums are maybe the best albums of all time that can make you understand things in ways that you didn't understand and open up all of your horizons. But no one knows, you know, it's a really small collection of people who would have seen him live on the scene, who have actually gone to this band camp or whatever from the past and heard these things. We don't get to hear them anymore. They cut us off. They hide us from each other. They stop us from listening to the good music that will. And the mainstream is full of logical fallacies rather than logic, I think. I think it's just full of their negative, toxic logic, you know, logical fallacies being used to trick people, where real logic comes out from the heart, comes out from the soul, comes out from music, comes out from musicians who are in touch with their heart and in touch with the soul and in touch with people, other people, and what's best for like humankind in general. And those people have found that through music as well, by just repeating rhythms and songs and chords and expressing emotion into something that's music allows you other ways to see the world. It's like learning a language. It starts to open up another piece of your mind and allows your mind to do a little bit more.
Yeah, I also wonder, you know, I think great artists are not often great marketers. I come from the 90s when it was like Kurt Cobain, and it was like you were supposed to act like you were appalled at the idea that anyone would market your music at all. And, oh, I guess, aw shucks, I'm an accidental genius, and if you're going to market me and make me gazillions of dollars, then fine, I guess I have to endure it. I mean, that was sort of the attitude. And I think marketing is obviously an art form, right? But great artists in music probably don't possess that, and they don't possess that nearly to the same degree as big business suit guys do in at the top of like pop stars, you know, teams, so to speak.
Yeah,
so I wonder if an artist like Addict what is his name, Addict or Attic?
Ed Ake. So Ed, E-D,
Ed
Ake. Ake, as in
well, that's
Ake,
the problem right there, Johnny. You can't remember his name. It's too, no, but I wonder if he's still going for it, and if he's then realizing, oh, you know what? I need to invest some of the same time I invested in writing these epic songs into learning marketing. I mean, and learning social media and all that kind of stuff. I think a lot of artists I hate social media, and I get it. But this day and age, I feel like we have to start, sort of addressing the situation for what it is. And I think real great art can rise up again. It just needs to learn how to compete in a similar way to the pop stars. Maybe that's naive.
I think there's, you've got to understand there's a difference between now and the past. Like, we go back into the past when these guys before rose up, and what they had was all of the infrastructure and the means to be found by spotters who were going around and were looking for authentic sounds in certain areas. Those we're looking for authentic sounds disappeared probably late 70s, early 80s, and got replaced with we're looking for the sound that sells. And after that, we've got everybody has to put a sheen on it to get up to the big time. But these guys who are really got the message, have got the thought, have got the insight. Yes, they're not going to be good at marketing, but they would once upon a time have been picked up by a really good scout who says, look at you, I can see what the potential is for you to not only reach into the charts and to make good music, but also to reach across a message. And sometimes you can see they've got all the potential, like a unit has got the potential, and you put them up there and you give them the opportunity, and that potential just shines, just like blows people's minds, just makes people go crazy, and suddenly you've got like the fever, the Beatles fever. It's like it's all fake nowadays. It's just people going, I want picture of you, 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 and it's all for so that they can look good, rather than you know, oh, I'm here with my hero. It's like, oh no, I'm here with someone that makes me more important. So everything's got this narcissistic twist on it, and that wasn't what music was like back in the day of people like Dylan and the like. I think they came up through a system that allowed and helped to create an authentic music scene on the ground so that they could go there and pick from them. And man, my city's decimated for music, you know, compared to what it was back then. So
Wales is interesting, man. I mean, Chad Blake lives out there, great mixer, producer. I met him, I've worked with him a bunch through Peter Gabriel. And I mean, what you just described kind of happened to me in the 90s through Peter Gabriel and Lou Reed, funnily enough. They came to my show and recorded me and then signed me to Peter Gabriel's label. And it was like that. I got to be just an artist and put my stuff out there and act like I was appalled by people trying to market it. That whole thing, you know. You know, it's interesting that you bring up Dylan and those kind of guys, because I listen to social media stuff and how to do it. And people talk about you got to film yourself. And there is that ego thing you said, the narcissistic thing of filming yourself, of being your own marketing guy. There's something kind of grotesque about that on the face of it. But if you think about it, like Dylan or even the Stones and the Beatles, we saw them through these films, you know, Don't Look Back with Bob Dylan. I mean, that was Instagram and TikTok back in the day, but it was just much more artfully done. It was way cooler. It was other people approaching them with cameras. And these days, I think artists have to kind of adopt that same attitude, only it's even more difficult and complex because you're doing it yourself. So there's something, and then plus you're in a landscape of millions of other people doing it. So I don't know, man. I think you have to, as a musician, you sort of have to measure your expectations and realize that you can make an impact. It just won't be mass adoption. You'll make an impact if you work really, really hard. You can make an impact on 1,000 fans or something like that. And then it can have a butterfly effect. I think that's the attitude you have to take.
It's a good attitude to take, but also I kind of like have this positive outlook, because I see how the change has happened, but that change doesn't necessarily mean the worst thing in the world. It just means that maybe people later on in the future, that's when their music will be discovered. When a new set of circumstances changes technologically, a new algorithm is put in, and suddenly everybody finds all of these wonderful artists from the past because people are bored of listening to reggaeton beats over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, in exactly the same way with, you know, unemotive words or lyrics put to it. Like, people will want to listen to things that are authentic and will discover that all of these small artists exist, but the algorithm couldn't find them. than before because of how marketing works. So I hope there's a change eventually in technology that allows for a retrospective look at music, and that's when we'll see another boom for the people who have made music in the past. Like, it's still positive.
Do you black pill yourself with it? Like, do you think the music industry has sort of taken the soul out of music on purpose as a setup to subjugate and control humanity? Do you think there's a conspiracy behind it, or do you think it's just pop culture gravitates to the lowest common denominator?
Yeah, the people who like to get the money are the people who are on top, and they want what sells, you know, and they attract other people like them. So the system will automatically turn like that anyway. And then what will that lead to? Well, that will lead to influence operations. So we're hearing about the P. Diddy case, and that really sounds like another influence operation. P. Diddy's got a massive following. He's connections all over the place. He's streaming around. What did the intelligence agencies do? They come in, they co-opt them. People like Scooter Braun, who manages people like Ariana Grande, he's really suspicious. You look at these people and you go, wait a minute, what are these guys up to? And they look like intelligence assets, because that's where influence and power is. So you have suddenly a murky gangster world. But music always had like a gangstery element. Most of the clubs in the day, you
Sinatra, baby.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Clive Davis. I don't know if you heard the Suge Knight interview on Patrick Bet David's Valuetainment podcast. He spoke to him from jail, and Suge Knight was saying like, "Yeah, P. Diddy's just one of the people in the train of people that this happens to. It happened to him. He learned it," and he mentioned, I don't know if I should mention names he mentioned, but big heavyweights in the music business. I think he mentioned, I don't know, do I say it? Allegedly Clive Davis or whatever. I don't know. He said it was a long train of this kind of activity happening. I mean, how satanic do you think it gets, really? Let me take a quick break since we're already way past break time. It's just too fun to talk to Johnny Vedmore. We'll be right back after these words on TNT.
TNT's Rick Munn.
There's a really funny, let's just say, report from the Northern Ireland COVID inquiry that started yesterday in Belfast. And I quote the chief medical officer, Sir Michael McBride, how he described the Northern Ireland government ministers as dysfunctional bastards. Yes, that's how he described the ministers of Northern Ireland. I can't disagree with that, but it's a little bit like the pot calling the kettle black. If there's a dysfunctional bastard in Northern Ireland, it's Michael McBride. The pot, the kettle black. Talk about having a brass neck. I don't know what's going on with that man, but undoubtedly we're in for an absolute circus.
Locked and Loaded with Rick Munn on today's News Talk TNT.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's News Talk TNT Radio should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody,
and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity.
If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Plug in.
Website?
tntradio.live.
Check it out.
Today's News Talk Radio.
It's the coolest.
TNT.
And we're back with Johnny Vedmore. So we were just talking about the P. Diddy case and basically just how evil the music industry potentially is. I mean, I've been in the music industry. It never got that evil. It was, in my case, I was, you know, wasn't in those sort of rooms, I guess. But, I mean, how believable do you think all this is? How dark do you think it goes? And what do you think is going to happen with P. Diddy?
I think humans go dark, whether they play music, whether they're in films, whether they're in politics, it makes no difference. Is there someone who wants to corrupt you and wants to catch you in the act, and they want to exploit you, and they want to blackmail you and extort you? Because that's what this is probably more about, is that someone else held something over somebody else and made them commit a certain amount of negative actions because they had that information. That's extortion rather than blackmail, you know. That's evil stuff. That's what evil people do when they're trying to manipulate people. So it doesn't take away what other people do, but people are quick to say, oh, I want to save my career and save all of this like fame and celebrity I get over, you know, what I want to live like as a person. And it's hard. It's hard. Once you get any type of influence at all, you start to lose your mind to some sort of extent. You can't stop yourself committing negative actions. You're more likely to go back onto drugs or get hooked on drinking or something, because you're just like, you need to get rid of this sort of situational pressure you get from all of the parts of life, which are really difficult. And then once you've kind of like learned how to deal with all those things, all of those negative things that you do, that those impulses kind of disappear. But a lot of these people don't have support, don't have help, and also have a massive ego, so think they're the best thing since sliced bread. There's no chance that anything can go wrong for them, and those people end up right at the top, you know, getting it, taking advantage of the most and enjoying it and becoming the same beast as what the abuser puts upon them, and then they become an abuser. It's just like in abuse anyway. It's like, you know what, 10% of people will become abusers, but like there's a 0.1% of people will be the ultimate manipulators. And once they found those people, they want to keep those people doing the manipulative actions. They want to keep them doing that. And so the music industry will be full of them, because it's all about influence, and that's what influence operations are. They want to influence people, and they need to be in the center. The other thing is the targeting of young minds is something that has gone on for thousands of years systematically. Every generation has come to the same conclusion: the only way you take over society eventually within your lifetime is to take over the youth. And if you program the minds of the youth, then you will get them to do whatever you want. Music is the best way to do that. It's like, it's better, it's quick, fast acting. You can get a message straight into someone's head. I mean, it is like, people have been too scared by the ideas of conspiracy theories and what people think about you for believing in something. But if there's influence to be had, negative people will be drawn towards influence, and they will use it against other people, some of those people.
I'm wondering why they're not more afraid of the state of their soul. I wonder why they like sort of surrender to evil so readily. I mean, there is another option. And if you have success, you could, I mean, I guess it was, you know, it's easier for a rich man to go through, or no, for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. So I guess ever since Jesus said that, you know, it's been the state of humanity. It's just, if you have power, if you have influence, you're likely to turn away from God, I guess. I guess that's just how we're designed. It seems an odd design flaw in humanity. Yeah. Because the thing is, if you have success and you have a platform, you could do so much good with it. You know, you have the freedom to actually just create beautiful messages. And I guess people like John Lennon, people like Lou Reed, you know, Leonard Cohen, Bob Dylan, there's people that do get those platforms and make beautiful stuff with it. But I suppose they're less and less all the time, although they do exist. I mean, I'm thinking of, for some reason, talking to you makes me think of the band Sleaford Mods. This conversation, because that's a band, you know, they're underground compared to Taylor Swift, but they're huge in terms of, you know, new music that has really high quality lyrics and sort of a punk rock aesthetic. And yet they still acquiesce to like, take the jab. It's kind of odd. What's your take on those guys?
That's the problem, is that if you're willing to bend to the worst forms of marketing, then you'll end up being a vaccine plugging pop idol. You know, it's just the way of life within the music industry. It was heartbreaking, man. It was heartbreaking seeing Dave Grohl on stage, plugging that, like every day out there being the man, being the little bitch for the man, being just down on his knees. It's just unbelievable. Couldn't even rationalize it in my head. Eddie Vedder, oh man, these were guys who were just like, I was just in love with the what they did. Oh man, Neil Young, he's like the needle and the damage done. You can't, come on, you just cannot, you cannot write, have written a song like that and not find it ironic that
keep rocking in the free world, man. Keep rocking in the free world, and then you know, going pro censorship. It's so odd because those artists are the type that could have taken that cultural hit. You know, if Dave Grohl would have spoken out, you know, of course there would have been legions of people saying, you know, what a lunatic, that bastard. But he's getting that on the back end anyway. I mean, I would think he would want influence from free-minded people that were brave, you know. Instead, he's alienated all those people, and you know, the sort of burden of social shame in the moment, he couldn't see past it, I guess, or maybe he just really believed it. I don't know. It's odd that we didn't have more mainstream artists or like people that have those punk rock values actually stand up with a punk rock counterculture stance, because that was the time to sort of really prove your muscle and your might. I mean, if Dave Grohl would have done that, wow, can you imagine
even
the respect he would have? Yeah.
Even Fat Mike. I mean, Run Fat Mike, come on. I mean, that's ridiculous. That is ridiculous. That is
Sleaford Mods. That was the punkiest band I've heard for ages, and I loved them. And I still love them. I mean, I love the music. It really doesn't make me hate people's music. I can't do that. I still love Neil Young, you know, but...
Yeah, I'd listened to him for about a year beforehand. Like, I'd been just on this, like, Neil Young fix for about maybe even a year and a half. I just was just going through every single song. I mean, some of them are just amazing. It's just, my God.
The first Neil Young record, he wrote, like, four of those songs in a fever in one day. Cowgirl in the Sand or whatever. And anyway, yeah, everybody knows This Is Nowhere, one of the best rock and roll records of all time. Talk about your music situation, man. I was like, who is this Johnny Vedmore guy? He's my colleague on TNT. He's awesome. He's cool. Everybody loves him. But what's up with his past? He's a musician. He's got records out. Are you still making music? Have you been disappointed by the music business? Your music is good. I hope you don't leave it at the side of the road.
No. I got a few things in the works. But at the moment, like... I was a desperate musician from the moment I picked up a guitar, and I loved it. And then I was in a heavy metal band when I was young. I just wrote songs. I had like lived with a lot of anxiety, drug addiction, stuff like that for years and years and years. And my guitar and playing and writing songs was everything to me. And I'm one of those, you know, you musicians, especially like guitarists, singer-songwriters. There's a difference between them. Some people either play other people's stuff all of the time, and some people create their own, and there's some people who just can't cross over on either side. And I'm never really that interested in playing other people's stuff. I was interested in writing song after song. And I, you know, you go through so many points of like ego, lack of ego, attack on the ego when you're trying to make it in the music business in any way. And I played in gigs with a band called Bomb Alaska. I made it was a fantastic band, really, really good music. But of course, there's always splits and problems within projects. And I just wanted to go on my own. So I was like running it alongside, as I was starting to become a journalist in about 2016-17, and I was starting to write, I was like running it alongside, and it became like I write, then I do a bit of music, then I do a little bit of this and I do a little bit of that, and my life became a nice routine. Like, but then the journalism took over for a while, and I've concentrated then on being like, okay, I'm gonna learn something new, because I'm gonna be going around, I'm gonna start getting on the synth. So like I write loads of since so all my videos on newspace.com and all my videos on YouTube and etc. all have my own music across them. So I spend a lot of time simping. So when I did the docuseries searching for Stanley, every episode has got like two songs for that episode, and you know, I'm really, really liking to spread my stuff, spread my talents around and see what I can find. But I come to terms with the fact that it's too hard to compete with people. And I was going to be doing journalism for a long time, and I just didn't have the time or the patience to like get back into studio sort of mode. So I kind of like come to terms with the fact, right, I'm just going to leave that on the side. It's my pet project. I can go back to it whenever I want, but I still play, of course. It's just, I'm just this so much work when it comes down to investigating the elite establishment and the people who run the world. I mean, that's my reels. Like, that's something I'm super talented at, is finding information no one else can find and writing it down. And what I learned, and this is really important, like, when I write the articles about Klaus Schwab, like his father, about revealing who his father was, revealing his training through CIA-funded programs, other stuff like that, the articles are written in like a song format. And people probably don't realize that, but what I have is like this process of being like, I have an intro, then I have verse, chorus, verse, chorus, verse, chorus, then I have a middle eight, I have a solo, maybe an outro, and I end it like that. So I learned to attach my like structural songwriting ability over to writing as well. So I still feel like I'm writing songs when I'm writing articles as well, but I just very lyric heavy. That's it.
Have you ever thought about presenting them as songs? I think that could go viral.
Yeah, I that could go viral, but that's kind of what I'm doing with the docuseries, is that, you know, I really think about the type of tunes that I want to make for those, and I've got loads of plans for the future, and all of it's got a bit of music attached. But I just do music for my own stuff. I do the graphics, I do the editing, I do the production, I do the mastering, I do the drafting, I do the narration, I do everything, because I just, if I don't, then things don't get done, because I have to rely on people who are like, yeah man, I'll do it, and it takes forever. So I just learned to do everything, and that includes music, and I love music, but it's hard. It's a hard thing to get your head above water, and I've got quite a good back catalog of maybe 40 something songs, and I've got some songs on the way which are just, I mean, they're like best work stuff, and I'm very proud of them. But I don't expect anybody to listen to them or like them. That way, I really become very happy with what I'm doing, and I don't really care what other people think of it. It's very bad for marketing, but I don't really want to achieve that with music. I'm happy achieving this elsewhere, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, yeah, you gotta put your expectations, I guess, to the side and still somehow go for it, you know, and not lose your passion. But it's interesting what you're saying about having to learn so many different skill sets. I think that's the thing that's surprising now. You can't just do one thing, you know, and survive. You could, but no one will hear it. You have to market yourself, you have to make video content, you have to learn how to edit, you have to do all that kind of stuff, and you have to remain consistent. Do you struggle at all with what Steven Pressfield calls in the War of Art with resistance? Do you have days, do you deal with sort of your own mental hang-ups in terms of keeping your work focused and doing it every day? Do you deal with depression? How do you overcome?
Yeah, man. Oh, deep, dark stuff in times. Like, I mean, life is just a collection of happiness, love, and trauma. And it's just like unrelenting. We have to accept, you have to be kind of like water. And, you know, I say that with a bit of a heavy heart, because you know that you're pushing down something when you have to be like water. You're pushing down it. You also have to get rid of your ego. At some point, you've just got to be like, I don't really care what people think of me. I don't I love, like, you've got to try and love yourself, but that's hard when you're constantly working. You don't give time to yourself. You don't give time. I suffered from anxiety loads when, I mean, really bad, like OCD stuff back probably about 15 years ago. And they put me on loads of medications and nothing helped, of course. It just made things worse. So it just like now I have to like manage anything like that just by being, you know, knowing that I just got to keep doing. The doing is a bit that if I don't do, gives me anxiety or stresses me out or makes me depressed. So for me, I just got to at the moment keep going. But in the same way, like I say, heavy heart, because it means you push down a load, the more work you push out. But I think everybody gets it. You come to a stage in your life where you're like, this is the point where I've got to push out my best. I got to, you know, work really hard, and I've got to do a lot. I've got to try and find a way to fit my soul into that and make myself happy, you know, and that's really hard, really difficult. So yeah, man, I tell you, I would love to have a happy, supportive life, but I've got bits of happiness and bits of support. Just no one gets all happiness and all support. People only get what you can, you know, it's 50-50, and we got to not be negative as well. It's very easy with a negativity bias to feel negative.
Talking about trauma and stuff like OCD, have you ever investigated ketamine therapies? There's like people that do infusions, and apparently it's like super effective. It rewires your brain. It creates new neural pathways. It gives you strange psychedelic insights. You sort of disembody, and you perceive yourself in a different way, and it also restructures your brain. I've been doing a little research on it, and I've heard a lot of people that get cured from stuff like OCD doing stuff like that. Allegedly, I'm not suggesting it for anyone out there, but it's something worth looking into.
I definitely talk about this regularly, because my life went from at one point being completely like down to the end, suicidal, addicted to loads of drugs. I mean, loads of drugs. I got down to morphine at one point, and when you get down to morphine, you know life's bad. And I got out of that partially via mushrooms and psychedelic experiences for about 3 to 6 months, really heavy. And then a load of other things, including ketamine and stuff. And I tell you, one thing that you learn is that you end up sitting around in a room full of grown men and you're all crying about your emotional trauma. That's what happens. And that's what we need to get over. You know, you need what I learned from doing stuff like that. And I just don't feel the need to do it anymore, because I've gone through the process so much that I don't feel the need for, you know, anything over like a magic mushroom once a year, or maybe something, you know, trip once a year. But I don't actually feel the need to take drugs, because I went through a process where I learned what they can give to you and what they can help you with. And I completely agree with all of that. I mean, it's just so obvious that if you can talk about trauma, then you get over trauma. If you don't talk about trauma, it gets 20, 100 times worse exponentially through your life until you break down completely. So the only way to get over trauma sometimes for some people is to become out of their mind and to be able to drop their ego. And that's really hard, because you've been taught to put barriers up around your ego and around your soul and around all of this. And you just got to let go of it all. You just got to be like, I am one with the world. And you can do that really easily through a different form of mindset, and it's amazing for some people, would be terrible for others. And that's partially down to the fact of where people are on their journey of recovery from trauma, because life is full of traumas, and even the least traumatic experiences are traumatic to people who have had no other form of trauma. You know, it's trauma is relative to the person who's experiencing it. So everybody has trauma in some way. We may belittle someone else's trauma, but they have trauma nonetheless, and it's the, all of the ills of the world are due to that. This certain amount of drugs, mostly natural drugs, some things like ketamine and DMT and stuff that really just, obviously people like Terence McKenna and, have talked about DMT and how it can let the little fairies in your mind expand your mind, and loads of people, you know, they've done medical trials where it's just changed people's, all people's existence, like their whole mindset has changed in a much more positive way. And it's all about letting go of trauma, and we're getting back in control of what I think Dr. Heath talked about the other day on my show, which was getting in control of your negativity bias, being able to see that life isn't so bad.
I was watching some of that interview. It's interesting. Like the human, he was saying that the human mind veers towards negativity. It has to. I guess it's a survival mechanism. The old ego. Anyway, let me take a quick break. We'll be right back after these words on TNT.
As a combat wounded veteran, I know how hard it is to come home and build a meaningful life. When I was in Iraq, our vehicle was hit. A rocket-propelled grenade exploded right under my seat. Traumatic brain injury, a fractured pelvis, severe burns. They didn't think I was going to make it. I had to learn to walk again and live with the scars, both visible and invisible.
DAV helps veterans like LaToya get the benefits they've earned. They help more than 1 million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
With DAV on my side, I was able to pursue my dreams. If my story can touch a heart, it can change a life. My victory is overcoming my wounds so I can help other veterans.
LaToya Lucas, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
My character Shazam knows all about growing up in a family full of teenage superheroes. They're bold.
Where's everyone going?
To fight crime.
Okay.
Adventurous.
Shazam!
There's never a dull moment. And no matter what happens, they'll always have your back. All they need is a place to grow and be themselves. And the best part is, you don't have to be a superhero to adopt a teen. Learn more about adopting a teen from foster care. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward.
You're with Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And we're back with Johnny Vedmore talking about trauma and overcoming it and how all human beings are encumbered by it. Why do you think that is, Johnny? Why do you think it's designed this way? That you know, we're in this predicament as human beings where we have to overcome this ego and yet use the ego to sort of survive. But then and then we have this connection with God, hopefully. I mean, do you have faith? How much does spirituality factor into your recovery from all these things in your life moving forward?
Oh man, I went through a load of different experiences to try and understand what the difference between God, spirituality, my own understanding of what is good and what is evil, and how to view that through a lens which doesn't leave you feeling, you know, completely and utterly distraught or super hyper religious or able to be taken advantage of by a certain group. You know, I'm all about like avoiding people taking advantage of me, and religion is rife with that. And I learned something really, you know, for me, I believe that we're probably, the most likely scenario is that we're in a simulation, 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 over and over and again, down a long list of ever unfolding simulations that differ in size and scope every single time, and it's an eternal process. And I think that is something that the God figure in that is the person who runs programs and understands the simulation. But in the same sense, that simulation is made up by the dynamics that you can't help to escape, that are, you can transpose over to nearly every single base religious ideology of love, and that follow the lines of love and happiness and meaning in life and finding good meaning in life, all of the positive stuff is all of there, and all of the negative stuff is all there, and it's all a test. The whole thing feels like a test. You're being tested all of the time in many different ways, and you will fail over and over again because we also simulate our behavior over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. And we just like it, whatever way you look at it, with these really tiny small blips, we may seem insignificant, but that then leaves you to what? It leaves you to realizing the only thing that you can do is have positive output in whatever system this is, whatever world this is, whatever reality this is, whatever sub-reality this may be. You just got to have this sort of understanding that the only thing I can put out is positivity, and I will fail in doing that at times, love. But the only thing I can do is, yeah, put out love, put love, out the love, good. Love. So
all you need is love. Wait, Johnny, let me ask you this, though, about the simulation, because it seems like the idea that everyone's going, and I fall into it as well. Yeah, okay, we're in a simulation. Everybody's sort of, I remember when I first heard that concept, it seemed really out there, and it seems to have, you know, gaining momentum. It seems like almost like where it's taken over, like, okay, we're in a simulation. But it's all based on the fact that, like, okay, we started in video games in 1980 with Pong, and now look how good video games are. And pretty soon we won't be able to distinguish this reality from a digital reality. That only means that we're tricking our own human senses, which are very limited, right? We have 5, maybe 6, you know, if you believe in being psychic or whatever, you know. That's not a big sort of, that's not that impressive to trick our own senses. Our own senses are notoriously limited. We know that. So I kind of almost think like, I don't know, I'm sort of like resisting the simulation theory, even though, yeah, of course, obviously technology will advance to a degree where human senses will not be able to tell the difference between digital reality and so-called reality. But that doesn't take away so-called reality. I mean, we're so complicated. We're so multifaceted, our bodies, you know, there's so much going on that we can't perceive anyway. So I think the simulation theory sort of makes God like a computer programmer or something. I don't know.
Yeah, the problem is that the what you just described is what someone in a simulation would say at some point within the simulation. So they keep you in this sort of like box that you can't get out of.
The simulation.
Yeah, exactly. No, but that's what it feels like.
Though it becomes just like another way of saying reality. Then
yes,
like,
yes, yes, yes. That's what I'm saying. Mean? So
it's
the
just
big,
a new
the
word
picture.
For reality. Then
yeah, the big you know? Picture. Has to be this idea that, okay, if you are this thing that exists within this massive realm of like sub-realities and on top of sub-realities all of the way down, isn't that godly that it got made and it got created like this? And isn't this our vision of God and the actual program that it may be, whether we describe it like that, or we could just look at the fact that programs are made up with calculations and algorithms and other things that can be measured in the same way that our reality is. So it's exactly the same. There's no difference. It makes us hyper special. It makes us really super special. It makes our existence extremely special. And it might mean something even more important. But what it does, you know, there is a way to, and it's happened recently for me, where I started to view the world in a way that's numbers, yeah? And I met Ash Mahmood, who does some amazing movie stuff. And he was so wonderful and lovely as a person, so welcoming and love. His messages were just full of love, just such an honestly nice person that it blew me away. I mean, blew me away. And I had been thinking up this, I had been coming to terms with how to react with other people on a basis, on a system. because I started to realize people were either zeros or ones. And the base way to explain this, you walk past someone, they look at you in the street and you say hello. That's a one. You're each giving each other a one. You're giving a positive output, they're giving a positive output. But the people who keep their heads down and don't look up and don't want to see the rest of the world, they're giving you a zero. So a zero and one will make nothing. But if you get a one and a one, that's the start of a relationship. That's really good. That's the start of like saying hello to someone. That's the start of creating energy from mass. It's the start of making things happen. That's what life's all about, is making really positive things happen. But then meeting Ash Mahmood made me realize there's twos. There's people who are so lovely that they fill you full of joy and lift you up in a different way. So that means there's zeros, ones, and twos. But then there's got to be three, which has got to be love. And then you can probably think there's probably a reverse scale there. There's minus ones, the people who will do something nasty to you when they see you in the street. Minus twos, the people who will trick and distort reality just to take advantage of you, and the narcissists of the world. And maybe it's just a level to measure narcissism to empathy. And then free, the most hateful, murderous, nasty people in the world, you know? There is a way to look at it like on a scale.
We are zeros and ones, twos and threes, fours and fives. Some of you are negative ones and twos and negative threes and fours and fives. Johnny Vedmore has an interesting way to think. Anyway, we could make a song with that. Like, that was a lot like the intro song, though, so I'm repeating myself. But what's the point of defining it? And that was awesome, by the way. I loved it. But why define it as numbers when we could define it as, I think it's more helpful, or sort of that intellectualizes it, right? Whereas I think our battle as human beings is ultimately being brave enough to allow love in. Have you ever noticed that, like, you know, when you really let love in, it's a very vulnerable feeling, right? Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes when we come up with these theories of like, this is a one and this is a two and this is a three, it's to keep it on the level of the mind. Whereas because the mind feels like it wants to protect us. And so like your guy that you just interviewed on the fantastic TNT, who was saying our minds veer towards a negativity bias, right? And so to let go of all that and just be nothing, right? Like just to let love in, that's the boldest thing you can do. But there's no place for your ego in that equation.
How do you step across that boundary? How do you step across it? How do you find love? How do you get from the point, you know, nearly everybody who meets everybody could probably fall in love in some way if they were able to let their ego down and their defenses down at some point. And usually it takes people having a little drinky poos at the local bar and meeting each other and going and fluttering eyelids and being, I just happened to be standing next to this person and this thing has happened. And, you know, We find it hard to put ourselves in a situation of vulnerability. So I think what I'm saying is just like, if you can rationalize it on the real level, on the level of reality in the mind, then you can step over that box, because you can realize I've met someone who gives me back a positive response, and I can recognize that because on a scale I understand in reality, and then maybe we can get over the next that little hump. Get over the hump, if you know what I mean, and get to the point where you actually fall in love, and that needs you to have a cognitive process to let yourself go, to let yourself be free enough to be loved. We all know that term, you know. You have to let yourself be loved, and for that you need to get over that vulnerability, and for it, it could help a lot of people to understand it on a cognitive level, and then the rest follows afterwards.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, but I still think you're putting the mind up on the pedestal at that point. There's no place, they both can't exist at the same time, or you can only sort of worship one God, so to speak. So if you're either sort of coming from a heart space or spirit or presence, or coming from the mind. Anyway, wow, there's the music. Johnny, you're amazing, dude. It was really fun to talk to you. I hope this is not the first time. Love you, brother. God bless you, man. I'm giving you a great big two and three right now.
You get it straight back. Straight back. I love it. The freeze is my favorite.
Ooh. All right. Johnny Vedmore show on TNT. He's amazing. Listen to him, folks. He might have shades on. He might not. Anyway, I got to go. We'll be right back after these words on TNT.